Despite the great and certain worldly rewards for staying healthy and fit, they are not the sole or even the main reason to seek and embrace the habits of good health. The greatest benefits to health are found in the mind and spirit and soul of the seeker. Being a person of strong character is the best prescription for a sound mind and a sound body. If you are a person of strong character, you will promise yourself that you will achieve your goals or what? It doesn't matter, because you never consider that possibility. You have made a promise, and you're going to keep it. When you set out to drive to the grocery store, you don't stop at the doorway and think, "What will I do if I don't make it?" You simply intend to get to the grocery store. You know you're going to get there. You will get there. It's simply assumed. Fear is simply the inability to make a promise to yourself. It kicks in when you start thinking about all the bad things that can happen to you on the way to your destination. And before long, you're thinking, "Wouldn't it be easier just to stay home? Isn't it safer to just stay in bed? Isn't it better to pull the covers up over my head?" When you were learning how to walk, you made a silent promise to yourself that you were going to do it. It may have been scary at times. You surely stumbled again and again. Tears surely fell from your eyes, but no matter. You didn't even think about that. Each time you fell, you forgot about it as soon as you regained your feet, because you had promised yourself you were going to walk across the room. And you did it. How long did it take? Who cares? You did it. Ask yourself, are you a person who comes to a fork in the road and turns right or left? Or do you stop the car, scratch your chin, and say, "Well, maybe I'll go this way, and then again, maybe I'll go that way"? And in the end, you go nowhere. Are you the kind of person who comes to a decision and puts it into action? Or are you someone who says, "Well, maybe, but then again, maybe not"? Having to is a lot stronger than wanting to. But often, and especially when you're young, that difference isn't always clear until someone points it out to you. You have enough talent and intelligence to really accomplish a lot in life, but you just don't have enough reasons to make it happen. A person of truly strong character sees success as an adventure, not as a point with an estimated time of arrival. True patience is more than just a waiting game. Patience doesn't mean you sit around hoping for something to happen. Patience is not a passive quality. Sometimes patience can mean doing something else entirely, thinking about another venture, taking off in a different direction, while you give events a chance to run their course. Impatient thinking can lead a person into some very big mistakes. You have to lose your life in order to find it. If you have your health, you have everything. Lose your health, and there isn't enough money in all the world to make life good or to make you feel like life is worth living. You have to lose one way of living in order to find a different one. One that's better suited to who you are at this particular time. But you can do that, though it takes character. You have to lose your life in order to find it, but you can lose your life and you can find a new one. A healthy attitude. Your attitude, the slant you put on things, the way you lean into life or back away from it, is all part of your character. Good health is more than just the absence of illness. It's more than just not being sick. Good health is the direct result of right thinking and right living. In other words, of strong character. Anybody who does the same thing every day, year in and year out, with no break or vacation, is probably in no position to even know whether he or she is in good shape. You can't know what you have until you leave it, or lose it, or get something else. You just can't sharpen your mind like a pencil so it comes to a fine point, but always gets shorter and shorter until it's worn down to a stub and has to be discarded. Remember, every dream is a vacation. Feeling right makes others feel right, and they in turn give back what's inside them, the very confidence that you give out. A patient man is always richer than an impatient one, even if the patient man has less money. A patient man is always richer than the impatient one because the patient man can always afford to wait. The patient man is never desperate. The patient man has time to spare, while the man in a hurry is always on the verge of bankruptcy as far as time is concerned. In any situation you can think of, impatience is a source of weakness and fear, while patience is substance and strength. You should simply refuse to compromise. You should similarly refuse to accept pettiness or dishonesty or unethical behavior in any form. If your character is good and strong, there are certain things that you simply refuse to accept in yourself or in other people. In your work, you refuse to accept anything less than your best effort. That doesn't mean that things will always work out exactly as you hoped and intended, but that's not the point. So embrace your fear, take it inside yourself, and use it as a foundation for true courage. There will always be variables you can't control, but your effort level should always be maxed out regardless. Very few people are able to develop this kind of intrinsic motivation. That's just an axiom of human nature. Let's suppose that there's a vast, hugely powerful force that nobody can withstand. And this immense force is always active and in furious motion. It never rests. It's like a slowly flowing river that can eventually carve the Grand Canyon out of solid rock. Now, in trying to achieve your life's goals, would you prefer to fight against this great force? Would you want to struggle against this mighty power that has all the odds overwhelmingly in its favor? Or would you rather enlist this great power in your cause and make the inevitable work for you instead of against you? By the way, time is that great power I'm talking about. History proves that time is the strongest ally you can possibly have, no matter what the odds against you or the level of adversity you're facing. Time gives strength to those who have it on their side. Why would you ever choose to fight time when you could have time on your side? Who wouldn't want to harness the great river of time that flows through all of life?
What should I do? How should I live? And whom should I become? We need the guidance of both ancient wisdom and modern science to get the balance right. What is the meaning of life? Why do some people find meaning, purpose, and fulfillment in life, but others do not? Where does happiness come from? For what the flesh desires is opposed to the spirit, and what the spirit desires is opposed to the flesh. For these are opposed to each other, to prevent you from doing what you want. If passion drives, let reason hold the reins. Desire and reason are pulling in different directions. Feelings of guilt, lust, or fear are often stronger than reasoning. Freud said that the mind is divided into three parts: the ego, the conscious, rational self; the superego, the conscience, a sometimes too rigid commitment to the rules of society; and the id, the desire for pleasure, lots of it, sooner rather than later. Human thinking depends on metaphor. The driver, the ego, struggles frantically to control a hungry, lustful, and disobedient horse, the id, while the driver's father, the superego, sits in the back seat lecturing the driver on what he is doing wrong. For Freud, the goal of psychoanalysis was to escape this pitiful state by strengthening the ego, thus giving it more control over the id and more independence from the superego. The older metaphors about controlling animals work beautifully. Throughout recorded history, people have lived with and tried to control animals, and these animals made their way into ancient metaphors. Buddha, for example, compared the mind to a wild elephant. In days gone by, this mind of mine used to stray wherever selfish desire or lust or pleasure would lead it. Today, this mind does not stray and is under the harmony of control, even as a wild elephant is controlled by the trainer. Plato used a similar metaphor in which the self, or soul, is a chariot, and the calm, rational part of the mind holds the reins. Plato's charioteer had to control two horses. The horse that is on the right, or nobler side, is upright in frame and well-jointed, with a high neck and a regal nose. He is a lover of honor, with modesty and self-control. Companion to true glory, he needs no whip and is guided by verbal commands alone. The other horse is a crooked, great jumble of limbs, companion to wild boasts and indecency. He is shaggy around the ears, deaf as a post, and just barely yields to horsewhip and goad combined. It's no accident that we find the carnal pleasures so rewarding. Our brains, like rat brains, are wired so that food and sex give us little bursts of dopamine, the neurotransmitter that is the brain's way of making us enjoy the activities that are good for the survival of our genes. Plato's bad horse plays an important role in pulling us toward these things, which helped our ancestors survive and succeed in becoming our ancestors. The controlled system allows people to think about long-term goals and thereby escape the tyranny of the here and now, the automatic triggering of temptation by the sight of tempting objects. People can imagine alternatives that are not visually present. They can weigh long-term health risks against present pleasures, and they can learn in conversation about which choices will bring success and prestige. The automatic system has its finger on the dopamine release button. The controlled system, in contrast, is better seen as an advisor. It's a rider placed on the elephant's back to help the elephant make better choices. Once you understand the power of stimulus control, you can use it to your advantage by changing the stimuli in your environment and avoiding undesirable ones. Or if that's not possible, by filling your consciousness with thoughts about their less tempting aspects. Buddhism, for example, in an effort to break people's carnal attachment to their own and others' flesh, developed methods of meditating on decaying corpses. By choosing to stare at something that revolts the automatic system, the rider can begin to change what the elephant will want in the future. The rider can see farther into the future, and the rider can learn valuable information by talking to other riders. The rider is an advisor or servant, not a king, president, or charioteer with a firm grip on the reins. It is conscious, controlled thought. The elephant, in contrast, is everything else. The elephant includes the gut feelings, visceral reactions, emotions, and intuitions that comprise much of the automatic system. The elephant and rider each have their own intelligence, and when they work together well, they enable the unique brilliance of human beings. To understand the most important ideas in psychology, you need to understand how the mind is divided into parts that sometimes conflict. We assume that there is one person in each body, but in some ways we are each more like a committee whose members have been thrown together to do a job, but who often find themselves working at cross purposes. Human rationality depends critically on sophisticated emotionality. It is only because our emotional brains work so well that our reasoning can work at all. Reason and emotion must both work together to create intelligent behavior. The moment one stops trying to suppress a thought, the thought comes flooding in and becomes even harder to banish. When controlled processing tries to influence thought, "Don't think about a white bear," it sets up an explicit goal. And whenever one pursues a goal, a part of the mind automatically monitors progress so that it can order corrections or know when success has been achieved. When that goal is an action in the world, such as arriving at the airport on time, this feedback system works well. But when the goal is mental, it backfires. Automatic processes continually check. Am I not thinking about a white bear? As the act of monitoring for the absence of the thought introduces the thought, the person must try even harder to divert consciousness. Automatic and controlled processes end up working at cross purposes, firing each other up to ever greater exertions. But because controlled processes tire quickly, eventually the inexhaustible automatic processes run unopposed, conjuring up herds of white bears. Thus, the attempt to remove an unpleasant thought can guarantee it a place on your frequent playlist of mental ruminations. We sometimes fall into the view that we are fighting with our unconscious, our id, our animal self. But really, we are the whole thing. We are the rider and we are the elephant. Both have their strengths and special skills. Marcus Aurelius wrote, "The whole universe is change, and life itself is but what you deem it." Buddha taught, "What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind. Events in the world affect us only through our interpretations of them. So, if we can control our interpretations, we can control our world. There is no reality, only perception. The art of pop psychology is to develop a method, beyond lecturing and hectoring, that guides people to that realization. Self-help books and seminars sometimes seem to consist of little more than lecturing and hectoring people until they understand this idea and its implications for their lives. To take something philosophically means to accept a great misfortune without weeping or even suffering. We use this term in part because of the calmness, self-control, and courage that three ancient philosophers, Socrates, Seneca, and Boethius, showed while they awaited their executions. But in the Consolation of Philosophy, which Boethius wrote while in prison, he confessed that at first he was anything but philosophical. He wept and wrote poems about weeping. He cursed injustice and old age and the goddess of fortune who had blessed him and then abandoned him. Then one night, while Boethius is wallowing in his wretchedness, the majestic apparition of Lady Philosophy visits him and proceeds to chide him for his unphilosophical behavior. Lady Philosophy then guides Boethius through reinterpretations that foreshadow modern cognitive therapy. She begins by asking Boethius to think about his relationship with the goddess of fortune. Philosophy reminds Boethius that fortune is fickle, coming and going as she pleases. Boethius took fortune as his mistress, fully aware of her ways, and she stayed with him for a long time. What right has he now to demand that she be chained to his side? Lady Philosophy presents Fortune's defense. Why should I alone be deprived of my rights? The heavens are permitted to grant bright days, then blot them out with dark nights. The year may decorate the face of the earth with flowers and fruits, then make it barren again with clouds and frost. The sea is allowed to invite the sailor with fair weather, then terrify him with storms. Shall I then permit man's insatiable cupidity to tie me down to a sameness that is alien to my habits? Lady Philosophy reframes change as normal and as the right of fortune. The whole universe is change, Aurelius had said. Boethius was fortunate. Now he is not. That is no cause for anger. Rather, he should be grateful that he enjoyed fortune for so long, and he should be calm now that she has left him. No man can ever be secure until he has been forsaken by fortune. Lady Philosophy tries several other reframing tactics. She points out that his wife, sons, and father are each dearer to him than his own life, and all four still live. She helps him see that adverse fortune is more beneficial than good fortune. The latter only makes men greedy for more, but adversity makes them strong. And she draws Boethius's imagination far up into the heavens so that he can look down on the earth and see it as a tiny speck on which even tinier people play out their comical and ultimately insignificant ambitions. She gets him to admit that riches and fame bring anxiety and avarice, not peace and happiness. After being shown these new perspectives and having his old assumptions challenged, Boethius is finally prepared to absorb the greatest lesson of all. The lesson Buddha and Aurelius had taught centuries earlier. Nothing is miserable unless you think it so. And on the other hand, nothing brings happiness unless you are content with it. When he takes this lesson to heart, Boethius frees himself from his mental prison. He regains his composure, writes a book that has comforted people for centuries, and faces his death with dignity. Epiphanies can be life-altering, but most fade in days or weeks. The writer can't just decide to change and then order the elephant to go along with the program. Lasting change can come only by retraining the elephant, and that's hard to do. When pop psychology programs are successful in helping people, which they sometimes are, they succeed not because of the initial moment of insight, but because they find ways to alter people's behavior over the following months. They keep people involved with the program long enough to retrain the elephant. When pleasure or pain comes to them, the wise feel above pleasure and pain. Do not seek to have events happen as you want them to, but instead want them to happen as they do happen, and your life will go well. Happiness comes from within, and it cannot be found by making the world conform to your desires. Our life is the creation of our mind. Thinking makes it so. When heaven is about to confer a great responsibility on any man, it will exercise his mind with suffering, subject his sinews and bones to hard work, expose his body to hunger, put him to poverty, place obstacles in the paths of his deeds so as to stimulate his mind, harden his nature, and improve wherever he is incompetent. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. This chapter is about what we might call the adversity hypothesis, which says that people need adversity, setbacks, and perhaps even trauma to reach the highest levels of strength, fulfillment, and personal development. I don't want to have this chance, but it's here now. And what am I going to do about it? Am I going to rise to the occasion? For decades, research in health psychology focused on stress and its damaging effects. A major concern in this research literature has always been resilience, the ways people cope with adversity, fend off damage, and bounce back to normal functioning. Researchers have gone beyond resilience and begun to focus on the benefits of severe stress. Post-traumatic growth. In direct contrast to post-traumatic stress disorder, researchers have now studied people facing many kinds of adversity, including cancer, heart disease, HIV, rape, assault, paralysis, infertility, house fires, plane crashes, and earthquakes. How people cope with the loss of their strongest attachments, children, spouses or partners, and parents. Rising to a challenge reveals your hidden abilities, and seeing these abilities changes your self-concept. None of us knows what we are really capable of enduring. You might say to yourself, I would die if I lost X, or I could never survive what Y is going through. If you did lose X or find yourself in the same position as Y, your heart would not stop beating. You would respond to the world as you found it, and most of those responses would be automatic. People sometimes say they are numb or on autopilot after a terrible loss or trauma. Consciousness is severely altered, yet somehow the body keeps moving. Over the next few weeks, some degree of normalcy returns as one struggles to make sense of the loss and of one's altered circumstances. What doesn't kill you makes you, by definition, a survivor, about whom people then say, I could never survive what Y is going through. One of the most common lessons people draw from bereavement or trauma is that they are much stronger than they realized. This new appreciation of their strength then gives them confidence to face future challenges. And they are not just confabulating a silver lining to wrap around a dark cloud. People who have suffered through battle, rape, concentration camps, or traumatic personal losses often seem to be inoculated against future stress. They recover more quickly, in part because they know they can cope. Suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. The person who has had more experience of hardships can stand more firmly in the face of problems than the person who has never experienced suffering. From this angle, then, some suffering can be a good lesson for life. Trauma changes priorities and philosophies toward the present. The reality that people often wake up to is that life is a gift they have been taking for granted. I don't want to celebrate suffering, prescribe it for everyone, or minimize the moral imperative to reduce it where we can. I don't want to ignore the pain that ripples out from each diagnosis of cancer, spreading fear along lines of kinship and friendship. I want only to make the point that suffering is not always all bad for all people. There is usually some good mixed in with the bad, and those who find it have found something precious, a key to moral and spiritual development. Must we suffer? Adversity may be necessary for growth because it forces you to stop speeding along the road of life, allowing you to notice the paths that were branching off all along and to think about where you really want to end up. Human beings were shaped by evolutionary processes to pursue success, not happiness. People enthusiastically pursue goals that will help them win prestige in zero-sum competitions. Success in these competitions feels good, but gives no lasting pleasure, and it raises the bar for future success. When tragedy strikes, however, it knocks you off the treadmill and forces a decision. hop back on and return to business as usual, or try something else? There is a window of time, just a few weeks or months after the tragedy, during which you are more open to something else. During this time, achievement goals often lose their allure, sometimes coming to seem pointless. Many people change their goals in the wake of adversity. They resolve to work less, to love and play more. If in those first few months you take action, you do something that changes your daily life, then the changes might stick. But if you do nothing more than make a resolution, "I must never forget my new outlook on life," then you will soon slip back into old habits and pursue old goals. You need interesting material to write a good story. You can't have a good life story without vicissitudes. Several genres are associated with well-being. In the commitment story, the protagonist has a supportive family background, is sensitized early in life to the sufferings of others, is guided by a clear and compelling personal ideology, and at some point transforms or redeems failures, mistakes, or crises into a positive outcome, a process that often involves setting new goals that commit the self to helping others. In contrast, some people's life stories show a contamination sequence in which emotionally positive events go bad and everything is spoiled. People who tell such stories are, not surprisingly, more likely to be depressed. Indeed, part of the pathology of depression is that while ruminating, the depressed person reworks her life narrative by using the tools of Beck's negative triad. I'm bad, the world is bad, and my future is dark. Although adversity that is not overcome can create a story of depressing bleakness, substantial adversity might be necessary for a meaningful story. Trauma often shatters belief systems and robs people of their sense of meaning. In so doing, it forces people to put the pieces back together, rebuilding beautifully those parts of their lives and life stories that they could never have torn down voluntarily. When people report having grown after coping with adversity, they could be trying to describe a new sense of inner coherence. This coherence might not be visible to one's friends, but it feels like growth, strength, maturity, and wisdom from the inside. When bad things happen to good people, we have a problem. We know consciously that life is unfair, but unconsciously we see the world through the lens of reciprocity. The downfall of an evil man, in our biased and moralistic assessment, is no puzzle. He had it coming to him. But when the victim was virtuous, we struggle to make sense of his tragedy. The desperate need to make sense of events can lead people to inaccurate conclusions. The ability to make sense of tragedy and then find benefit in it is the key that unlocks post-traumatic growth. Psychologists have devoted a great deal of effort to figuring out who benefits from trauma and who is crushed. The answer compounds the already great unfairness of life. Optimists are more likely to benefit than pessimists. People who have a basic level trait of optimism tend to develop a coping style that alternates between active coping and reappraisal. Because optimists expect their efforts to pay off, they go right to work fixing the problem. But if they fail, they expect that things usually work out for the best, and so they can't help but look for possible benefits. When they find them, they write a new chapter in their life story. A story of continual overcoming and growth. In contrast, people who have a relatively negative affective style live in a world filled with many more threats and have less confidence that they can deal with them. They develop a coping style that relies more heavily on avoidance and other defense mechanisms. They work harder to manage their pain than to fix their problems, so their problems often get worse. Drawing the lesson that the world is unjust and uncontrollable, and that things often work out for the worst, they weave this lesson into their life story where it contaminates the narrative. If you are a pessimist, you are probably feeling gloomy right now. But despair not. The key to growth is not optimism per se, it is the sense-making that optimists find easy. If you can find a way to make sense of adversity and draw constructive lessons from it, you can benefit too. You have to use words. And the words have to help you create a meaningful story. If you can write such a story, you can reap the benefits of reappraisal. Even years after an event, you can close a chapter of your life that was still open, still affecting your thoughts and preventing you from moving on with the larger narrative. Anyone, therefore, can benefit from adversity. The first step is to do what you can before adversity strikes to change your cognitive style. No matter how well or how poorly prepared you are when trouble strikes, at some point in the months afterwards, pull out a piece of paper and start writing. Don't edit or censor yourself. Don't worry about grammar or sentence structure. Just keep writing. Write about what happened, how you feel about it, and why you feel that way. If you hate to write, you can talk into a tape recorder. The crucial thing is to get your thoughts and feelings out without imposing any order on them, but in such a way that after a few days, some order is likely to emerge on its own. Before you conclude your last session, be sure you have done your best to answer these two questions. Why did this happen? What good might I derive from it? For everything, there is a season. The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. When it comes to explaining personality, it's always true that nature and nurture work together. If the adversity hypothesis is true, then there should be times in life when adversity will be more or less beneficial.
Things die. It is the way of life. All we can do is try to find a reason to go on. Build it again.
Keep on keeping on until the day breaks and the shadows flee away. The miracle working powers of your subconscious mind existed before you and I were born. All you have to do is unite mentally and emotionally with the good you wish to embody, and the creative powers of your subconscious will respond accordingly. A magnetized piece of steel will lift about 12 times its own weight, and if you demagnetize this same piece of steel, it will not even lift a feather. Similarly, there are two types of men. There is the magnetized man who is full of confidence and faith. He knows that he is born to win and to succeed. Then there is the type of man who is demagnetized. He is full of fears and doubts. Opportunities come, and he says, "I might fail. I might lose money. People will laugh at me." This type of man will not get very far in life, because if he is afraid to go forward, he will simply stay where he is. There is a gold mine within you from which you can extract everything you need to live life gloriously. Infinite riches are all around you if you will open your mental eyes and behold the treasure house of infinity within you. What, in your opinion, is the master secret of the ages? The secret of atomic energy, thermonuclear energy, the neutron bomb, interplanetary travel? No, not any of these. Then, what is this master secret? Where can one find it, and how can it be contacted and brought into action? The answer is extraordinarily simple. This secret is the marvelous miracle working power found in your own subconscious mind, the last place that most people would seek it. You can bring into your life more power, more wealth, more health, more happiness, and more joy by learning to contact and release the hidden power of your subconscious mind. You need not acquire this power. You already possess it. You want to learn how to use it, you want to understand it, so that you can apply it in all departments of your life. You can gain the necessary knowledge and understanding. You can be inspired by a new light, and you can generate a new force, enabling you to realize your hopes and make all your dreams come true. Within your subconscious depths lies infinite wisdom, infinite power, and infinite supply of all that is necessary, which is waiting for development and expression. There is a miraculous healing power in your subconscious that can heal the troubled mind and the broken heart. It can open the prison door of the mind and liberate you. It can free you from all kinds of material and physical bondage. You must not think that the principles of chemistry, physics, and mathematics differ from the principles of your subconscious mind. Let us consider a generally accepted principle. Water seeks its own level. This is a universal principle, which is applicable to water everywhere. Matter expands when heated. This is true everywhere, at any time, and under all circumstances. It is also a universal truth that whatever you impress on your subconscious mind is expressed on the screen of space as condition, experience, and event. Your subconscious mind is principle and works according to the law of belief. You must know what belief is, why it works, and how it works. The law of your mind is the law of belief. This means to believe in the way your mind works, to believe in belief itself. The belief of your mind is the thought of your mind. That is simple. Just that and nothing else. All your experiences, events, conditions, and acts are the reactions of your subconscious mind to your thoughts. Remember, it is not the thing believed in, but the belief in your own mind, which brings about the result. Cease believing in the false beliefs, opinions, superstitions, and fears of mankind. Begin to believe in the eternal verities and truths of life, which never change. Thought is incipient action. The reaction is the response from your subconscious mind, which corresponds with the nature of your thought. You are a gardener, and you are planting seeds, thoughts, in your subconscious mind all day long, based on your habitual thinking. As you sow in your subconscious mind, so shall you reap in your body and environment. Think quietly and with interest on these qualities, and accept them fully in your conscious reasoning mind. Continue to plant these wonderful seeds, thoughts as in the garden of your mind, and you will reap a glorious harvest. Your subconscious mind may be likened to soil, which will grow all kinds of seeds, good or bad. Every thought is therefore a cause, and every condition is an effect. For this reason, it is essential that you take charge of your thoughts so as to bring forth only desirable conditions. When your mind thinks correctly, when you understand the truth, when the thoughts deposited in your subconscious mind are constructive, harmonious and peaceful, the magic working power of your subconscious will respond and bring about harmonious conditions, agreeable surroundings, and the best of everything. In order to change external conditions, you must change the cause. Most men try to change conditions and circumstances by working with conditions and circumstances. To remove discord, confusion, lack, and limitation, you must remove the cause, and the cause is the way you are using your conscious mind, the way you are thinking and picturing in your mind. You are living in a fathomless sea of infinite riches. Your subconscious is every sensitive to your thoughts. Your thoughts form the mold or matrix through which the infinite intelligence, wisdom, vital forces, and energies of your subconscious flow. Your subconscious mind is reactive and responds to the nature of your thoughts. When your conscious mind, the little me, is full of fear, worry, and anxiety, the negative emotions engendered in your subconscious mind, the big me, are released and flood the conscious mind with a sense of panic, foreboding, and despair. You will perceive the main differences by the following illustration. The conscious mind is like the navigator or captain at the bridge of a ship. He directs the ship and signals orders to men in the engine room, who in turn control all the boilers, instruments, gauges, etc. The men in the engine room do not know where they are going. They follow orders. They would go on the rocks if the man in the bridge issued faulty or wrong instructions based on his findings with the compass, sextant, or other instruments. The men in the engine room obey him because he is in charge and issues orders, which are automatically obeyed. Members of the crew do not talk back to the captain, they simply carry out orders. The captain is the master of his ship and his decrees are carried out. Likewise, your conscious mind is the captain and the master of your ship, which represents your body, environment, and all your affairs. Your subconscious mind takes the orders you give it based upon what your conscious mind believes and accepts as true. The great secret possessed by the great men of all ages was their ability to contact and release the powers of their subconscious mind. You can do the same. Every thought is a cause, and every condition is an effect. You are like a captain navigating a ship. He must give the right orders, and likewise, you must give the right orders, thoughts and images, to your subconscious mind, which controls and governs all your experiences. Never use the terms, "I can't afford it," or "I can't do this." Your subconscious mind takes you at your word and sees to it that you do not have the money or the ability to do what you want to do. Affirm, "I can do all things through the power of my subconscious mind." The law of life is the law of belief. A belief is a thought in your mind. Change your thoughts and you change your destiny. Begin now to recognize these potentialities of your deeper mind, and they will take form in the world without. The infinite intelligence within your subconscious mind can reveal to you everything you need to know at every moment of time and point of space, provided you are open-minded and receptive. You have a mind, and you should learn how to use it. There are two levels of your mind, the conscious or rational level, and the subconscious or irrational level. You must remember that these are not two minds. They are merely two spheres of activity within one mind. Your conscious mind is the reasoning mind. It is that phase of mind which chooses. For example, you choose your books, your home, and your partner in life. You make all your decisions with your conscious mind. On the other hand, without any conscious choice on your part, your heart is kept functioning automatically, and the process of digestion, circulation, and breathing are carried on by your subconscious mind through processes independent of your conscious control. Your subconscious mind accepts what is impressed upon it or what you consciously believe. It does not reason things out like your conscious mind, and it does not argue with you controversially. Your subconscious mind is like the soil, which accepts any kind of seed, good or bad. Your thoughts are active and might be likened unto seeds. Negative, destructive thoughts continue to work negatively in your subconscious mind and in due time will come forth into outer experience, which corresponds with them. Remember, your subconscious mind does not engage in proving whether your thoughts are good or bad, true or false, but it responds according to the nature of your thoughts or suggestions. You think with your conscious mind, and whatever you habitually think sinks down into your subconscious mind, which creates according to the nature of your thoughts. Your subconscious mind is the seat of your emotions and is the creative mind. The main point to remember is once the subconscious mind accepts an idea, it begins to execute it. It is an interesting and subtle truth that the law of the subconscious mind works for good and bad ideas alike. This law, when applied in a negative way, is the cause of failure, frustration, and unhappiness. The law of your mind is this: you will get a reaction or response from your subconscious mind according to the nature of the thought or idea you hold in your conscious mind. If you have conveyed erroneous thoughts to your subconscious mind, the sure method of overcoming them is by the repetition of constructive, harmonious thoughts frequently repeated, which your subconscious mind accepts, thus forming new and healthy habits of thought and life, for your subconscious mind is the seat of habit. The habitual thinking of your conscious mind establishes deep grooves in your subconscious mind. This is very favorable for you if your habitual thoughts are harmonious, peaceful, and constructive. If you have indulged in fear, worry, and other destructive forms of thinking, the remedy is to recognize the omnipotence of your subconscious mind, being creative and one with your divine source, will proceed to create the freedom and happiness which you have earnestly decreed. You must realize by now that your conscious mind is the watchman at the gate, and its chief function is to protect your subconscious mind from false impressions.